This is a pretty cool album, I have to say.
Thank you.
And there, I think there's incredibly gorgeous moments, and I think there's moments that confuse me, and there are things that push my limits. I'm excited about it. How was it to put this piece together?
I mean, you know, we've known Dan Truman for a long time, and had worked on a piece of his called 5½ Gardens, and Dan, you know, based on that experience and just seeing the way Dan works, you know, he's a very collaborative person, and I think the four of us and so are also, we tend to default to, you know, collaborating heavily on stuff. We very rarely sort of just commission somebody, get a piece in the mail and play it. And with Dan, there was a lot of stuff that he came to the table with that had been workshopped over a long period of time that was very codified, and like you hit this woodblock at this time. Like the movement 120 BPM, you know, Dan, that was all scored out. There's no sort of chance or anything left. Not that we didn't have input into it, but Dan had really sort of scored that whole thing out. The fiddle movements, the three sort of the opening, the middle, and the last movement were sort of lead sheets that he gave us, and that had the melody. And he said, you know, what do you guys think? And I was like, well, I play steel drums. I would love to, you know, what if I played that melody on steel drums on this movement? What if I droned on this movement? And it's sort of different every time. When we do it live, there's little things that happen, and depending on the gear that we have in the hall that night, we'll do sort of slightly nuanced versions of those. But the movement, the feedback movement, he had come with sort of a framework for that movement and an idea of what he wanted to do with it. But past that, he's like, what do you guys got? And so all of the drum set stuff that you hear in that movement, the stuff that Jason wrote and Jason made up on the spot based on a sort of rhythmic cycle that Dan had in mind. So it sort of couldn't have existed in its form that you hear on the record were it not for our sort of just sitting in a room staring at each other and having like really great days where it's like, yes, that's it. That's what it should be. But then also having like 2 or 3 days where we're just staring at each other terrified because nothing is happening. You know, the sort of creative process where, you know, you have really successful days, but then there's other days where you're just like, we should just go eat ice cream because this is not going anywhere. So with Dan, it was a lot of sort of the whole spectrum, very, very sort of highly organized, lots of minutia that he had scored out ahead of time, but then stuff that was really open, that was hanging on a large idea, like the feedback movement with the rhythmic cycles and the bass drum sort of roaring through these chord progressions based on the prelude from the Well-Tempered Clavier. Sort of us hanging the minutia on it and coming up with it, you know, on the spot and in collaborative sessions. So it was a really, really sort of exhausting, but in the best possible way, sort of experience working with Dan on this.
You know, that feedback movement, the fourth movement of mm-hmm. of the Bach Prelude, and also I imagine there's just times of this creativeness that your guys are learning new technique. I mean, the whole idea of having these wires with joysticks, and I've watched the video, and if I hadn't seen the video, I wouldn't have. I would have thought it was like bowed, you know, percussion or something or other. And my mind was blown by this sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, I got to say, Dan is one of, you know, he founded the Princeton Laptop Orchestra, which I don't want to speak definitively, but I think was the first sort of laptop orchestra in the sense of, you know, what you think a laptop orchestra is. Like he got this grant to sort of start an orchestra of all people playing laptops at Princeton. And some of his students went on, there's a student, his name Gu, who went on to Stanford to start the Stanford Laptop Orchestra. He's written a bunch of apps for the iPhone and sort of like, you know, but it all started at Princeton with Dan. And one of the ways that he treated that laptop orchestra as sort of a lab was to take sort of standard, you know, video game controllers and things like that and hack into them and rewire the sort of coding inside of it to speak to a laptop and to speak to a specific program that would then analyze a sound sample to do something. So that tether stuff, those are actually golf game tethers for like a not for Nintendo Wii, but it's for some sort of like a golf game or something. And it comes with a pair of gloves and this cheesy little plastic golf club. And when you swing and you hold those tethers, the tethers sort of correspond with, you know, a computerized person swinging the golf club. But what Dan did is he hacked into it and had each tether speaking to a specific sound sample that was moving a cursor over, you know, a violin bow or a struck piano note or something. And every time you would stop, that cursor would sort of freeze over top of that part of the sound sample and would just play it over and over and over again. So that sort of like intense grinding that you hear sometimes is where, you know, he asked us to stop pulling the tethers at a specific spot. But that's just sort of like Dan has that weird genius in him that's just like, yeah, I can take this thing over here and sort of repurpose it for this other musical cast. And, you know, every time we play that piece on concert, you know, people go crazy. That's all they want to talk about with the golf game, the tethers, you know.
Yeah. I imagine it had to be, as you say, it's different every time it's live. To find a middle ground, I'm sure you guys wanted to play around with this as opposed to just go and say, yeah, we're going to record it for you, Dan, and that's it. Has your guys' interpretation, obviously, I mean, it depends on if you're here in San Antonio and you have just eaten great tacos or, you know, you're right, chilling out in New York. I mean, obviously, all those sort of things factor in. But I imagine it had to be a fun process of working with Dan and having live performances before you guys decided to quote unquote record it.
Yeah. I mean, we have endless, coffee and beer meetings when we're on the road, constantly trying to figure out how to be like, please don't, I'm not comparing ourselves to Radiohead or like Wilco, but like, you know, what a band does is they record an album, like the National is just going out on tour right now. They record an album, then they go out and tour it for 3 years or whatever. And then they go and they disappear. They record an album and they go out and tour it for a while, you know. We are sort of the opposite in that, like, we'll commission a piece like Dan's piece and then we'll tour it for 3 years and play it a ton and then finally decide to record it. And then once the album's out, we're not touring it anymore. You know, it's sort of like we always do things backwards. And we're trying to figure out how to sort of swap that. But I think with a piece like Dan's, it was sort of impossible for us to really know the piece well enough to put it on a record because there's so many twists and turns and so much finicky hardware. And, you know, we cut our teeth on the road doing that piece live so much so that when we went into the studio, we knew exactly what to do and how to sort of finesse the piece to make it sound great on a record. So in one sense, we really stand behind putting records out after we've toured them live. But I think it really does speak to the collaborative nature of the piece and the way that we sort of figured out how to play it. And for us, you know, I don't think we're alone here. For us, that's sort of the way that we do things. And there's no real substitute for just being in front of people and falling on your face sometimes and being like, okay, so next time I need to do this with this thing. And when the computer crashes, I need to know how to react to that and deal with that in a way that, like a live performer has to deal with things. And so it made it, when we went into the studio, we had fought all those battles already. And so we went into the studio, we knew exactly what to do and how to sort of add stuff onto it that you can't do live, you know, that you want to, we tracked a ton of stuff because you can't do some stuff live. And the fiddle tunes are a lot fuller and richer on the record than they tend to be live because, you know, there's only four of us. So it was a really good experience, but, you know, that said, we're trying to, our most recent project, Where We Live, we actually were like, we are going to record this piece and have a record so that when we go out and play it, when people ask if they can buy the record, we can say yes. I think we finally won that battle, but, you know, it took a long time.
Yeah. I know you guys did some fun stuff with the Cage Project, and this too has some neat things that folks may not expect. How did you guys decide to do this sort of, besides just a digital download, to do something fun?
I'll say for me personally, you know, we have been going back and forth a lot about, you know, what is the state of music? What is, what does, what is an album? You know, how long does a piece need to be before it's an EP? And then is it a full, before something is considered a full length record? And I think the digital age, you know, where it hit us the most was when we realized that like the MacBooks now are being sold without CD drives, and cars, you buy a car now, you have to ask for the CD player to be put in if you want, because everything just comes with an aux input that you plug your iPod into, you know? And so I think the combination of that, just realizing where technology is probably going to be in the next 10 years, and coupled with, you know, I create a ton more plastic, you know, a bunch of more CDs that are just going to choke the earth eventually, that people probably aren't going to, you know, probably just going to throw away because everything's in iTunes now. We decided to go the sort of repurposed route and try to go back to what merchandise I think used to encompass a lot. Like you look at old LPs, and you just see this beautiful artwork, both on the inside and on the outside. And, you know, artists back then when LPs were really thriving, and to some extent they still are. I mean, there's lots of bands who release on LPs. The artist who you commissioned to make the artwork has a 12 by 12 inch canvas to work on. The cassette tape was much smaller. The CD was maybe a little bigger, but it doesn't really speak to what, you know, album art could be. And so we went, I mean, we commissioned Frank Olinsky to come up with, you know, this beautiful artwork for the album. But the LP thing was sort of inspired by, you know, this I think it's Yesterday and Tomorrow. It's this it's a Beatles album called Yesterday and Tomorrow. I think that's the name of the album.
Yeah.
Originally they did, it's now known as the Butcher cover. They did this photo shoot for the album art, and it was a picture of them all sitting in a row with lab coats on, covered with baby doll parts and cuts of meat. It was really strange, like really, really strange. And they're all like smiling and holding like a baby doll head, and like there's this steak on Ringo's lap, you know. And they put the album out, and Capitol Records printed up like 70,000 of these records or whatever and sent them out. Well, when people like yourself, press people started to get these albums, they went crazy and they were like, this is ridiculous. What are you doing? And so Capitol Records recalled all of the records and made the Beatles reshoot, made them reshoot the album cover. So the album cover that you see now is a picture of them sitting on like a trunk, you know, like a traveling trunk, you know, wearing
right.
looking like the Beatles do, you know? And so instead of, you know, because they couldn't afford to just throw away all those records, they had a sticker commissioned or printed up, and they took all of the records that they could get and put a sticker of the new cover that they had shot over top of the Butcher one. And so now this, like, if you can find one of these albums that doesn't have the sticker on it or that has the sticker on it and you can see the underneath cover, it's like worth $30,000 or something ridiculous. But that idea sort of caught me a little bit because it's, you know, essentially they were repurposing these LPs that they had already cleaned out. And I thought, you know, how many times do you go to a record store, you see, you know, the dollar bin just with these albums that are left to die, you know, for 50 cents. And I thought, well, you know, we're on the road so much, you could roll into a town, have these stickers, go buy a bunch of dollar LPs, put the download card in, and put this beautiful artwork over top of LPs that are destined for the landfill anyway. So that's exactly what we did. And I think for us, it feels good because you're recycling this old stuff and making it look new. And still allowing the artist, like, you know, Frank Olinsky, to make this beautiful artwork on an actual canvas. And, you know, I don't know, it feels good to do that. And it's definitely a unique, for us, it was a unique spin on how we normally go with merch. The speaker drivers that you see are the stuff, that's the, did you get the LP and the speaker driver?
I got the speaker driver, yeah.
Okay. The speaker driver is the, that's exactly what we use in the feedback movement on the bass drum, is that element. And it's just, you know, that was sort of a way for us to say, hey, here's a unique way to listen to the album. Plug this into your iPod and put it on stuff to amplify the music, because that's what Dan did in the piece. And, you know, I think for future releases, we're really going to try to think of, like, you know, what makes this piece unique? What is the unique way to have people listen to the piece? Is there something cool about this particular album that, you know, you don't get to, you know, we never use speaker drivers in anything else. So for us, it was a cool way to sort of to speak to what Dan was thinking of, and give you know, the listener a unique way to listen to things.
Oh, yeah.
I hope that explains it. But, you know, basically, we're just trying to recycle old things and come up with something that's sort of the anti-CD. And, you know, I think I saw somebody walking around Brooklyn with an actual Walkman the other day, and I got paranoid for a second. But then I was like, wait a minute, you know, he's just walking around with the Walkman to be ironic. Like, that's not the way things are actually going. I think digital is basically going to keep taking over. And so we're trying to take it back to, you know, merchandise as art.
Yeah. Oh, it's very fun. Well, what else are you guys, obviously this is a pretty cool release. What else is in the fire for you guys? Where are you off to this month?
Well, you know, this month, well, we just got back from London. We did the world premiere of a concerto for percussion quartet and orchestra by David Lang with the BBC Orchestra. And so for us, that's, you know, I don't think we're doing anything. We're doing it with the LA Phil to the fall of 2014. So we got a second to wait on that. But for us, that's been the big iron in the fire as of late. But we're doing the CD release party for this album this weekend at the Met Museum. And we're playing a project with John Colpitz, who is he's the you know, Man Forever.
I don't know.
He's a drummer, and he does this like pretty amazing, like long form, like super ecstatic drumming pieces that are amazing. And so we're going to play with him. We have our big summer festival that we do down at Princeton every year for college percussionists called SOCI, the So Percussion Summer Institute. We have a week-long residency at River to River where we're doing sort of an installation of this project that we did back in December called Where We Live, which is all original stuff. So we're sort of set up in this storefront playing for a week with different guest artists and things like that.
Oh, cool.
We have a project. We recorded an album with Glenn Cacci from Wilco. He wrote us a bunch of drum set quartets that we recorded with him, and I think we're working on sort of editing and mixing for an eventual release, I believe, next spring, but could be wrong about that. But that's sort of our next thing that's coming out.
Oh, cool. Well, we'll keep an eye on it and really enjoy neither Anvil or Pulley. Josh, it's great to talk to you.
Likewise. Nice to talk to you as well, John.